Welcome everybody. This is the second lecture in the course Perspectives on Bhikkhuni Ordination run by the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative in cooperation with the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies, both at the University of Hamburg. And today the lecture will be on the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya on Bhikkhuni Ordination. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Ann Herrmann, who will be presenting this topic to us. Ann Herrmann did her PhD in 1998 in Oriental Languages and Cultures. And at present, she is a professor of Chinese language and culture. And she is the head of the Center for Buddhist Studies at the University in Belgium, Ghent University in Belgium. Ann Herrmann has published extensively, in particular on Chinese Buddhist monasticism and on the development of disciplinary rules. She has translated the Bhikkhuni Dhammaguptaka Vinaya under the title Rules for Nuns according to the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya in 2002 by Motilal. She is also in collaboration with Stefan Peter Bumbacher in 2007 published The Spread of Buddhism, Brill, and A Pure Mind in a Clean Body with Mathieu Talk, Academia Press, 2012. So we all look forward to hearing what she has to offer on the issue of Bhikkhuni ordination in the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya, which in a way brings us into the area of Vinaya literature proper. In the last lecture, we looked at an account of the foundation of the Bhikkhuni order as it is preserved in the discourses and in Vinaya texts. And so now we move on to Vinayas proper, starting with the Vinaya that is also preserved in Chinese translation, the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya. I hand over to Ann Herrmann.
Hello everyone, I think you can hear and see me. So, Bhikkhunanda, thank you very much for the introduction. And thank you all for joining us. I hope we have an interesting lecture, and of course any questions will be welcome afterwards. I will try to answer them as soon as possible. I have to warn you a little bit, I have a very busy 1 week ahead of me, but after that I will be more free, so please have a little bit of patience if I don't answer immediately, but I promise you I certainly will answer. As you can see today, my talk will be on the Bhikkhuni ordination and especially the role of the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya in the Bhikkhuni ordination. Now, as you can see on this handout, I will discuss a lot the role of Buddhist nuns between past and present and what it actually means to be a Dhammaguptaka Bhikkhuni or a Dhammaguptaka Bhikshu. We will first have a look at the sources and questions, so the sources I'm using for this research and for my talk, and the questions that come out of it. Then we have a look at the spread of the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya. Now with the spread, I will limit myself, because we don't have that much time, although 1 hour and half is already quite a lot, but I will limit myself to the spread of the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya from India. What did it mean in India? What does it mean in Central Asia? How did it come to China? And how did the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya play a role in the first nunneries in China? Of course, I will go also into the issue of what the first nunneries in China are and what their role today is or might be. The fourth point will be some Dhammaguptaka regulations. Of course, as Bhikkhunalio has already explained, many Vinayas have very, very similar rules. I will repeat a few of them, but I would like to also point out a few particularities of the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya itself. Before then, we come to a conclusion. So let me start by just introducing a few terms. I will use the words monk and nun, so the terminology will be monk and nun, but by using the terminology of monk and nun, I will particularly refer to bhikshu and bhikshuni. That is, the fully ordained monks and nuns according to the procedures as they have been laid down, prescribed, suggested also sometimes by disciplinary texts, by the Vinaya. monks and nuns together will then make the Ubhaya Sangha, the Sangha, the community, of course, as you all know, and Ubhaya, the twofold community. Of course, I'm very much aware that terms like monk and nun also involve some Western implications, so I will try not to think about that. And also that, for instance, the words monk and certainly the word nun, the term nun, can be used for religious women who have chosen another option than to be fully ordained according to the Vinaya procedures. But in the next lectures, you will hear a lot about alternatives, other means to lead a religious life. So I will use today the words of the terms monk and nun, referring to bhikshu and bhikshuni. As you probably all know, today there are three Vinaya traditions in which one can currently be ordained. This is, first of all, the Pali Vinaya or the Theravada Vinaya that is used in Southeast Asia. There are, of course, different groups, different possibilities, but basically they all go back to one Pali Vinaya, the Theravada Vinaya, as we know it today, written in Pali. The second Vinaya that is used for ordinations is the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya that is used in East Asia. With East Asia, I refer to China and all the areas that have been influenced by China, of course, including Taiwan, Hong Kong, and so on, but also, for instance, Vietnam, Korea, to a very minor extent today, also Japan. This is a tradition that was a very Chinese tradition, and of course, I will focus my talk today on the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. The third Vinaya that is still used for ordination is the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, as it's used in Tibet, of course, in all the Tibetan regions, and in every tradition that wants to follow the Tibetan tradition. The sources I will be using are thus the Pali Vinaya, the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, and the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, but these sources are not the only sources that are extant. There are quite some other Vinayas that have come to us and that we can still study and read. In fact, as you see on the screen, there are six full Vinayas that today are extant and that we can use. And I will give you a few figures on these Vinayas so that you have an idea how complex the situation of translation, but also of the spread of these Vinayas was all over, let's say, India and then, of course, China. First of all, we have the Pali Vinaya, the Theravada Vinaya. As some of you might know, the Pali or Theravada Vinaya one day has been translated also into Chinese. This was at the end of the 5th century. But, and this is what the Chinese sources tell us, so the Chinese historical sources tell us, the translation of this Vinaya went lost very soon after its translation. It was done in the south of China, in the region of Canton, Guangzhou. And this was a very difficult region at that time because there was a lot of political turmoil. And apparently, according to the historical sources in China, the Vinaya never made it to the capital. And when a Vinaya translation never makes it to the capital, it means it cannot be included in the imperial library. And to be included in the imperial library was a very important feature to kind of be extant or to remain as a valid text for the next generations, because texts that were included in the imperial library were copied very often. If a text was not included in the imperial library, it very often disappeared. It depended on individual initiatives to still be extant, but very often texts not included in the imperial library tend to disappear. And this is the reason that historical sources at least mention for the disappearance of a translation of the Pali or Theravada Vinaya into Chinese. A very important point that, of course, we cannot go into today, but that might be interesting for some of you, is that, of course, we do not know which version exactly of the Pali Vinaya has been translated. It's a pity, of course, that this text is no longer extant, because it would have made a point of comparison with the extant Vinaya we have today. But unfortunately, we don't have it. And what is important, of course, then for us today, is that it means that this Pali Vinaya, or translation of the Pali Vinaya, was never used for any ordination ceremony in China. The other Vinayas that you find on your screen have all been translated into Chinese, and most of them are extant only in Chinese, which makes Chinese, and especially Buddhist Chinese, of course, a very interesting language to study when you want to study Vinaya or when you want to study the history of monasteries, institutions, and so on. I will give you a few figures, and I will sometimes also look at my paper just to be sure that I don't get the date wrong, because as you will see, a lot of these Vinayas have been translated in a very, very short period. In fact, the first Vinaya translations, or four Vinaya translations, were only made in the 5th century, but then very quickly, one after the other. And the first Vinaya texts that entered China all entered via the northern land routes, more commonly known as the Silk Roads. These texts all belong to the so-called northern tradition. So now I will not talk anymore about the Pali Theravada translation has been made, but specifically on the Chinese translations that you see on your handout. So these texts all belong to what we call belong to the northern group of the Vinayas, in opposition to the southern, the Pali tradition. Important is that at the end of the 4th century, no complete Vinaya had yet been translated into Chinese. But quite some institutions already existed. There were already quite some monasteries and even some nunneries in China, but they could not rely on a Chinese Vinaya text. So there was obviously quite a gap in knowledge maybe, or at least a gap in text available for the more and more institutions that we see in China. Some of the people would then invite monks from India to come with Vinaya text. Other monks, Chinese monks, would go to India in search of the Vinaya text. And the situation then, this lack of Vinaya, the situation changed then rapidly when in the beginning of the 5th century, four Vinayas were translated into Chinese. And the first to be translated, as you see on your screen, is the Sarvastivada Vinaya, translated under the title She Sung Lu, the Vinaya in 10 Recitations. It has been translated between 404 and 409 by Punyatrata, Kumarajiva and Harmaruchi, and revised a few years later by Vimalaksha. As you can see, it was really teamwork, and this is important in China because the 5th century was already a period where teamwork in translation became very important. And actually for the Vinaya translations, that also means that they are of excellent quality, which was not always the case for the very first translations done in China, and you have to go back then to the 2nd century, for instance. Of course, in the 2nd century, these were very interesting translations, but due to the teamwork in the 5th century, translations were very much improved, and this is the case also for the Vinaya translations. The translation team of the Sarvastivada Vinaya worked in the north of China, in the capital of Chang'an, And this means that it was immediately very much linked to the power of the state. So very often, and you have to remember, or you have to know also, that at that time in the north of China, there was actually quite some competition between smaller regions. China was not united in the 5th century. So Chang'an was, of course, still a very important town. It's the present town of Xi'an, between brackets. But there was a lot of competition between different regions at that time in China, especially in the north. Now, who brought the text? Now, according to tradition, it is Punyatrata, who was a Kashmiri monk, who brought the text with him, and Kumarajiva translated it into Chinese. It shows you that it was really teamwork, but also international teamwork. Because, for instance, Kumarajiva was born in Kucha. He was the son of an Indian father, and his mother was raised in a Kucha royal family. But the text was not yet finished when Punyatrata then passed away, and his task was taken over by another Western monk, who is then Harmaruchi, who is said to have brought a copy. So Harmaruchi would have brought another copy with him. And then finally, Vimalaksha would have revised the translation. And what is more, and this is very important for the rest of our discussion, is actually that Vimalaksha then took the text to southern China, where he also promoted the text. And because he promoted the text in southern China, it became a very important text also in southern China. And southern China at that time was united. in opposition to northern China, where we have a lot of different regions, in southern China, we have one emperor and we have a united China. So it's very important that Vimalaksha, actually, after this whole translation work, this international teamwork that had been done on the Sarvastivada Vinaya, took with him this translation work, improved it as a tradition once in the south of China, but then also makes it very popular in the south of China, and this will have an important impact. So this was the first Vinaya to be translated. A second Vinaya translated into Chinese is then the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. It has been translated under the title Su Fen Lu. Now, I have been working on the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya already about, 20 years, maybe even a little bit more, I would say, than 20 years. And it still remains a little bit a mystery for me why the title Su Fen Lu, a Vinaya in four parts. Of course, the Vinaya is now divided in four parts, that's true, and we also have Vinaya saying five parts, like the Mahishasaka Vinaya, we will discuss a little bit later. But why it has been divided in four parts, if anyone has any good idea or suggestion, well, you can always, of course, contact me. But anyhow, you should remember that Su Fen Lu is a title very often used also in commentaries referring to the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. It has been translated by Buddhayashas and Zhu Fonyin. Now, Buddhayashas is said to have memorized the text. So here we don't see that the text was brought for India, but the text was memorized and then translated by Zhu Fonyin. Zhu Fonyin, as you can hear from the name, Zhu means Indian, so it was probably someone related to an Indian family, but it was also someone who was bilingual. And again, we see this teamwork. Without going into too many details, I can also tell you that Buddhayashas and, I was 1 minute away, but I put on the screen again, that Buddhayashas and Kumarajiva, they also met each other. So these people worked on different teams, but still Buddhayashas and Kumarajiva were not unknown to each other. So they had discussions before. So that's maybe important to know, but I think it's important to know that all these people went along one road or different roads, met each other, and were really working in an international team. When these two vinayas were done, the Sarvastivada Vinaya and the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, in the north, no more vinayas were translated, no more new vinayas were translated. But the next vinayas you see is the translation of the Mahasanghika Vinaya and then the translation of the Mahishasaka Vinaya. These two vinayas were translated in the south of China, near to the capital Nanjing, so a modern capital Nanjing. Both of these vinayas were brought by Fa Xian, and I think most of you know who Fa Xian is. Fa Xian is a monk who lived in China and who at the end of the 4th century actually thought, well, we don't have vinayas in China, so I'm going to India to collect vinayas. And he leaves the north of China, Chang'an, in 399. If he would have waited a few more years, he probably would have seen the arrival of Kumarajiva and Buddhayashas. He might never have left China to look for vinayas, but at his time, in 399, the vinayas were not yet there, so he left for India to look for the vinayas. We know he left to look for vinayas because that's what he's writing in his travel account. So in his travel account, he clearly says, I'm going to India because I want to collect vinayas. So he goes to India, and of course he has to go, and I will show you a map a little bit later. He has to go through Central Asia, and he complains actually that in Central Asia he cannot find any Vinaya, because he says everything was transmitted orally. And this is also important. The oral transmission was probably already a little bit earlier in China, so before the translation of the four vinayas, but never a text apparently. And also in Central Asia, it seems to have been very difficult to find a text. So even at Fa Xian's time, the tradition, the Vinaya tradition, was very often transmitted in an oral way. So Fa Xian had to go all the way to Pataliputra, which is very deep already in India, well, of course, if you come from China, to find the first written text. And the first written text is actually some portions of the Sarvastivada Vinaya, and then a full Mahasanghika Vinaya, which he copies and takes with him. He then goes to Sri Lanka, and in Sri Lanka he finds the Mahishasaka Vinaya. I will come back to that point. And then he brings these texts with him, and they are translated then in China. The first to be translated, again in the 5th century, is the Mahasanghika Vinaya, and Fa Xian helps in the translation. The second text to be translated is then the Mahishasaka Vinaya, but at that time Fa Xian already passed away. After that time, we have 4 full Vinayas translated into Chinese, and of course you can imagine that first we had a lack of Vinayas. People were complaining, we don't have enough Vinayas, we don't know how to organize our monasteries, we would like to do it in accordance with what the Buddha has said. But then suddenly, in the beginning of the 5th century, we see that we have 4 Vinayas. And people, well, not immediately in the 5th century, but starting from the 6th and the 7th century, people start to discuss which Vinaya to follow. Because although many of these Vinayas, actually all these Vinayas, are very, very similar, they also have quite some differences, at least some little differences that might be important for some people when you have or when you want to follow strictly the procedures. When you look from them from afar, you can say, well, these differences are not so important. These differences, they are not really on the content. But on the procedures, there might be some differences. And people who are very much interested in procedures, they think, or they very often might think, that these differences are so important that one has to choose one Vinaya. So coming from a lack and a problem of a lack and a gap actually for Vinaya translations, we come to an overwhelming richness in the 5th century. In the 5th century itself, people seem to have been happy with the presence of a lot of Vinayas, but in the 6th and the 7th century, this started to cause a problem. And this is why, at least according to Yi Jing, the translator of the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, in the 8th century, so at the end of the 8th century, excuse me, at the end of the 7th century and the beginning of the 8th century, there was actually the need for a new Vinaya. Because Yi Jing says that all the Vinayas that now have been translated, that's all very nice, but actually they also have been spoiled. And spoiled in what way? They have been spoiled because many commentators have written their comments on this Vinaya, and so no one knows anymore what is right and what is wrong. So, a new translation is made by Yi Jing, and that is the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. Of this Vinaya, luckily for the researchers, large parts of the Sanskrit version are still extant, and very important also for those of you who know Tibetan, there is also a full translation of the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya into Tibetan. Of course, in China, one will not read the Tibetan version, and very often people also could not have access to the Sanskrit version, so the Chinese version was the most important one, and that is what Yi Jing was translating. So he translated the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya at the end of the 8th century. At the end of the 7th century, beginning of the 8th century. The main problem, actually, for the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya translated by Yi Jing was that exactly at the same time we can see the rise of the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya as the most important Vinaya in the Chinese monasteries. Because what happened? Well, first we had a lack of Vinaya. Then we had an overwhelming richness of Vinaya, 5th century. Then in the 6th and the 7th century, people start to discuss. They say, we need to choose one Vinaya. And the Vinaya that has been chosen was the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. I will return to the reasons why the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya has been chosen, but by the 7th century, and certainly by the beginning of the 8th century, the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya was firmly imposed as the only Vinaya to be followed for ordinations in China, to the extent that even the imperial court would intervene. Now by the 8th century, we have to remember, so the 7th and the 8th century, we have to know and to remember that at that time China was again unified. Just for those of you who don't know the Chinese history as well as others might be, so in the 5th century we have a split between the north and the south of China. in the north of China, there are a lot of competing regions. In the south of China, we have one unified Chinese emperor or empire. By the 7th and the 8th century, China is unified again. And it is in this unified one China that the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya is imposed by imperial decree in the beginning of the 8th century as the only Vinaya to be followed in China. Just at the same time when Yi Jing finishes his translation of the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. And the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, probably for political reasons thus, was not used as the Vinaya for ordinations. So what Yi Jing did was actually bring in another Vinaya, and people will study it, will refer to it, that's very clear. But it has never, probably never, there are some research for that, but probably never been used in China as a Vinaya for ordination. It was a Dharmaguptaka Vinaya that became the only Vinaya to be followed. So this is a bit the background of the Vinaya situation in China, and it is in this situation that the nunneries will develop. Of course, nunneries that develop mean that there has to be an ordination for nuns. And as many of you might know, there's actually only one extant or living tradition for nuns, that's the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. Exactly this, this tradition that has been created during the time I was just discussing, the 5th and 6th and 7th centuries. Now, I'm very much aware that today actually one could discuss, certainly, and I fully agree, that the Theravada Vinaya and Pali Vinaya has been revived, more particularly in Sri Lanka, but in the next lectures there will be enough room to discuss this revival, this reinstallment, or whatever you want to call it, and I'm sure that the next lectures will discuss that point in Sri Lanka. So this is important to know. But this is a very, very modern, one could say, a very new development. Until not so long ago, the Vinaya, the only Vinaya available for nuns, was the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, the Vinaya that is created or that is made or imposed in East Asia. While the other Vinayas, the Pali Vinaya, Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, and the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, they were, of course, and they are still available for the monks' tradition. So, the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya in East Asia, how? Maybe I think I should go a little bit into the details. Why the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya and why not any other Vinaya as the most important Vinaya for East Asia? And I will do that, of course, in the next slides. So, one very important question is the question that you find on this slide. What were the first ordinations? What were the first texts? And this is also a question that you find in early Chinese commentators, so in early Chinese discussions. And with early, I mean 6th, 7th, 8th century. People wanted to know which tradition was used for the first ordination, which text first came into China. And why they wanted to know that is because, or probably, we cannot be sure, but as they express, probably because they want the link with the Buddha to be as close as possible. So the first ordinations would be more legitimate than next ordinations. The first text to be used in monasteries would mean a lot for the Chinese communities of the period between the 5th and the 8th century. So people were starting to discuss which Vinayas were first. Now we have seen that this is a bit difficult to say because we know about the full translations, and in the 5th century we can clearly say that the Sarvastivada Vinaya, as you find again in your screen, and then the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya in the north coming over the Silk Roads were translated before the Mahasamhika Vinaya and the Mahashasika Vinaya were translated in the south. And I try to watch also a little bit the questions that I see on the left. So. Indeed, I think, and I will come back to your question, Bikonalayo, that in the beginning, in the 5th century, there seems to be a little bit of difficulty about knowing which tradition one belongs to, although one takes a text. but it's clear it's a very eclectic, if you can say it so. To the 5th century, actually, suddenly all these texts come in China, and China is also split between the north and the south, so the communication between the north and the south was possible, but not so easy. But by the 6th and the 7th century, people definitely become aware to which tradition they belong. And it's then that these discussions on which ordinations were first, which texts were first, will come into being and will be important, of course, maybe not so important for everyone, but important for those who make the ordination platforms. Those institutions who want to be in control of the ordinations, they really start to discuss it. So 5th century, very eclectic, and people might not have been so much aware. They were happy to have a Vinaya text. They were happy to be able to follow the procedures. But in the 6th and the 7th century, we see a lot of people discussing, yeah, but which Vinaya? Not every Vinaya says exactly the same, so we have to make a choice. Just a little bit of an interlude, because we have seen a lot of figures by now. I would like to show you a map, just to show you a bit what I mean with the travels of Fa Xian and what he has done and what it means to be in the north or in the south of China. So Fa Xian leaves from Chang'an, which is the present-day Xi'an, and then goes all over the Silk Road, the Northern Silk Road, one of the ways he could follow. And, well, if you remember, he left in 399. We do not exactly know when he has been born, but when he was born, but he was not a young man. So actually, I admire Fa Xian a lot for that at his age he could make this journey, because it was a very, very difficult journey. So he must have been very determined to go to India to find something. So he takes all this way, then he stays in Central Asia, he goes to India, and it's only when he arrives in this area that he finds the first text. That's what I meant when I say he has to go a long way to find the first written text. Then he goes to Sri Lanka, and this is a point I would like to return to. I have mentioned already a little bit in the lecture before. Actually, in Sri Lanka, and this is in the 5th century, he finds the Mahishasaka Vinaya. Now, until now, and if I'm mistaken, or if anyone knows anything, please just write it to me. I don't think that in Sri Lanka we have any historical reference or any historical proof of the fact that the Mahishasaka Vinaya ever has been used for an ordination. Because in the 5th century, and all the accounts refer to that, the Vinaya used in Sri Lanka was firmly the Pali Vinaya. Which version, that's more difficult to say, but firmly a Pali Theravada Vinaya established in the monasteries in Sri Lanka. As far as I know, I don't know of any historical reference saying that the Mahishasaka Vinaya was basically also used. It's of course never to be totally excluded, but I think it would be a very good guess to say that the Mahishasaka Vinaya was just there in a kind of library, that Fa Xian saw it, copied it, and took it with him then to China, but that there was no living tradition of the Mahishasaka Vinaya in Sri Lanka. Anyhow, Fa Xian takes with him the Sarvastivada Vinaya and the Mahishasaka Vinaya, and what is indeed very curious, and thank you, Kala Bikrini, to refer to that, is that he never took the Pali Vinaya with him from Sri Lanka. I think this is one of the major points that I always say, well, if someone has an answer to that, it would be very, very interesting, because I think that Fa Xian certainly was able to read a lot of texts by that time, and that the Pali language could not have been an obstacle for him to bring with him the text. So there are a lot of speculations we can have on that, and please just shoot and bring them to me. But what we can say is that Fa Xian brought the Mahasanika Vinaya and the Mahishasaka Vinaya, and he took the sea road to go back to China. Now, many of you might know that the sea road was not that easy, and that actually the ship on which Fa Xian was, well, it wanted to arrive in Guangzhou, but it arrived in the north of China, all the way in Shandong, And there's even a story, well, Fa Xian writes it in his travel account, that people wanted to throw Fa Xian out of the ship, but then finally there was some kind of consensus to keep him on the ship. So he arrived finally in Shandong and then traveled to the south of China in Nanjing, where then the first of the texts that he brought with him, the Mahasangika Vinaya, was translated, just to show the endeavor of Fa Xian. Now, the northern spread that actually we have seen, what I mean with the northern spread is then the spread over the Silk Roads. These spreads, or these Vinayas, were certainly earlier than the Vinayas that came over the Sea Road. So the northern spread actually then came from northwest India through Bactra and Gandhara. And of course there are a lot of inscriptions. Inscriptions one can find in Bactra, inscriptions one can find in Gandhara, that is present-day Pakistan and Afghanistan. And these inscriptions actually point to the fact that Dharmagupta Kavinaya was relatively important in these areas. There's a lot of new and fascinating material coming out. So this is certainly not a debate that is ended by this time, but we can at least make out or be quite certain that Dharmagupta Kavinaya was relatively important in the first centuries Anno Domine, of the Common Era, in that area, but then it declined in the later centuries. So it's not improbable that the Dharmaguptaka school or Dharmaguptaka monks would have been among the first monks to come to China. So if people say, I mean the earliest commentators in China say that the Dharmaguptaka monks were the first to enter China, we cannot verify it, but we also can say that it might have been so, because they were quite important in the first century Common Era in Central Asia. So it's certainly not impossible that the Dharmaguptaka school or the Dharmaguptaka monks were relatively important in the first transmission of Buddhism and also of Buddhist Vinaya text to China. Now, how important and early are the Dharmaguptaka Vinayas or the Dharmaguptakas? Well, we don't know 100% sure, but we do know that a lot of the texts they were using also Gandhari. So in the recent discoveries that we have on Buddhist texts, we can see that a lot of Gandhari has been used, and among the users of Gandhari were certainly also the Dharmaguptakas. Then we have some traditions, catalogues in China, referring to the early Dharmaguptakas. The first text that could have been translated into Chinese is a text translated in 250 Common Era, and of course I will focus on the Vinaya. When I say the first text, I only speak about Vinaya text now. Well, there is a tradition that in 250 Common Era, a Pratimoksha text, that's a list of rules, of the Mahasangika school has been translated into Chinese. So the first Pratimoksha text would then have been of the Mahasangika school. But this text is not extant, certainly not extant, and also, and that's important, it's not mentioned in the earliest extant catalogue that we have. That's the catalogue made by Sun Yo. But you can see the catalogue dates from the beginning of the 6th century. So some scholars doubt about the existence of this Pratimoksha text. Of course, it's not impossible, but it cannot have been widely spread if it has been translated at that time. The same period is mentioned for the early Karmavachana text. Now, there is a strong tradition saying that the earliest Karmavachana text, and Karmavachana texts are texts with procedures. So the procedures you need, for instance, for ordination. Well, that the earliest Karmavachana texts are two Dharmaguptaka texts, translated also in the middle of the 3rd century. Again, they are not mentioned in the early catalogue made by Sun Yo. So one could doubt again that these texts have actually been translated in the 3rd century, because the first catalogue that we have, the first extant catalogue that we have, does not mention these Dharmaguptaka texts. These texts are also claimed to be extant. So there are two numbers in the Taisho edition, and two numbers in this partial edition, so two texts in this partial edition, claim to have been translated in the middle of the 3rd century. However, if we study these two texts, these two Karmavachana texts, we can see that the language used is firmly language of the 5th century, and that these Karmavachana texts are so close to the translation of the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya made in the beginning of the 5th century, that in all probability the extant texts that we have are actually 5th century texts. But what is important for our discussion also is to know that the catalogues made after the beginning of the 6th century will say the earliest Karmavachana text or Dharmaguptaka text. So the earliest text available for ordination are Dharmaguptaka texts. Of course, it's also important to know that, or to remember that even if the extant text that we have today or not the text translated in the 3rd century, it does not make it impossible that in the 3rd century there was such a text. But again, it was probably not the text, if it has been there, it was certainly not the text widely spread, because people continue to complain about the lack of Vinaya text. So we have biographies of monks in the 4th century saying we don't have any text to rely on to organize our ordination. So even if there has been a text in the 3rd century, it was certainly not spread to that extent that all institutions just had access to this text. And I have been discussing a bit already these biographies. So the biographies, the earliest biographies that we have, well, first of all, the biographies of eminent monks, very well-known text called the Kalsanjuan, made in the beginning of the 6th century, and going back a few centuries, important to know, mostly the southern monks here are mentioned, so not many monks from the north. Most of the monks that you will see in the biographies of eminent monks all belong to the south. And maybe not surprisingly, if you have remembered my discussion on Vimalaksha, who brought the Sarvastivada Vinaya to the south of China and made it very important in the south of China, the monks we find in the biographies of eminent monks mostly belong to the Sarvastivada ordination line. If we go a little bit later to the first biographies of eminent monks compiled by Tao Xuan around 667, so in the 7th century, we see that the ordination line for the monks is the following. In the south, still mostly Sarvastivada, but now much more than in the former biographies of eminent monks, we also have reference to northern monks. And there we see that the Mahasangika Vinaya was actually the most important for the north, and some Dharmaguptaka. But we also see a growing importance of the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. You have to remember also that by the time of Tao Xuan, China was united again, which was not yet the case in the 6th century when we speak of the biographies of eminent monks of Hui Jiao. When we then go again further in time, and now I come to the Sung biographies of the eminent monks, and this is at the late 10th century, we see that in that Sarvastivada for the earliest monks mentioned in these Sung biographies of eminent monks, so the earliest monks still belong to the Sarvastivada tradition in the south. In the north they belong to the Dharmaguptaka tradition, so you can see that the Mahasangika tradition actually has disappeared. And then by the end of that period, not surprisingly, everyone belongs to the Dharmaguptaka tradition, or nearly everyone belongs to the Dharmaguptaka tradition. So you see a steadily, it's going on all the time, growing of the Dharmaguptaka tradition among the ordination lines of the monks mentioned in the biographies of eminent monks. We also have biographies of nuns. Unfortunately, we actually only have one big collection of biographies of nuns made in the early period. And this is a Pichuanichuan, the biographies of nuns made by probably Pao Chang. There's a lot of discussion if you really compiled these biographies. But what is important for us is that it has been compiled in the beginning of the 6th century, the century where Sarvastivada was still very important. And here we see also mentioning of the earliest ordination. The earliest ordination is then the ordination of the nun Jingjian, and this is done in 357. And actually 357 is the time when a full Vinaya had not yet been translated. But according to the biographies, the tradition used was the Mahisangaka tradition. And again, we can ask, is there any spread of this text? So if the Mahasangika tradition has been used for this earliest ordination, has this text been spread? Because afterwards people will complain again, and I start to repeat this story, start to complain again that there's actually no text for the institution. So again, a lot of question marks whether or not the Mahasangika Vinaya is really the or Vinaya used for the earliest ordination of Jingjian. In the biographies of nuns, we find actually only one nun who is said to possess a copy of the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. So certainly you can see that for the earliest ordinations or for the earliest nuns, the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya was not yet that important. Of course, I will come back to the first ordination of Jingjian, because of course it's not only the tradition that has been used that can pose a problem, but certainly the way in which the ordination was done. And this will become a major problem, not in the 4th century, but in the next centuries. Now, one final point to tell you why the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya then became so important, without going into all details, because firmly I want to focus after this more on the nuns themselves. But these are the last points to tell you why the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya then finally became so important. This is due to Tao Xuan, but of course not only to Tao Xuan, but to the monks and the monasteries that belong to the group Tao Xuan belongs to. Now Tao Xuan was a very important Vinaya monk, and he also had a lot of connections with the court. And he pleads for only one Vinaya. He is living in the 7th century, and by that time many people already start to discuss and say we need one Vinaya to be sure that everyone is ordained in the same way. Of course, if you want to control the ordinations, it's important and quite interesting to have only one Vinaya that is followed. And he claims that the first ordinations were the Dharmaguptaka ordinations. So he refers to this tradition that the first Karmavacana texts were Dharmaguptaka. So logically, he says, these are the monks that brought the Vinaya tradition, that brought the ordination to China, so we need to follow the Dharmaguptaka ordination. He also says that the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya includes Mahayana in opposition to the other Vinayas. That's of course a very debatable point, and I will not go into details here, I cannot discuss that now, but it might just have been something that Tao Xuan is using to strengthen his point that the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya should be the Vinaya. And of course he will make and his monastery also will make ordination platforms supported by the emperor, and the emperor also wanted one Vinaya because this was easier to control the newly unified empire. So one ordination tradition is very interesting for the imperial court. So it's not surprising that in the end we have even an edict imposing one ordination tradition, and that this edict, or at least this idea of imposing one ordination, has been followed by all institutions, is then confirmed by travelers such as I Ching, but also Japanese travelers who up from the 8th, 9th and so on century on will see and will write down in the travel accounts, in China one follows the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. Maybe without going again into a big discussion, but one point one can certainly discuss and do more research on, if I hope there are some more references that we can find, is how all the people, all these institutions then changed their ordination line from one Vinaya to the other. Was it without any opposition from one day on the other? How did it go? And so on. So many questions there, and well, maybe one or the other PhD topic. Who knows? This, by the way, is an 18th century drawing of Tao Xuan. So, just as a kind of interlude, so that you can relax a little bit before I go to the next point. Because now I want to focus on the first nunneries that come into being in this context. I will not repeat the whole story of Mahaprajapati. By this time you know it already very well, and you also know that she accepted 8 fundamental roles according to tradition. One of these roles is, after a nun has been trained as a probationer, Shikshamana, for 2 years, the ordination ceremony must be carried out in both orders, and as very well stressed in the commentaries or in the explanation in Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, for Dharmaguptaka Vinaya this means, and for many other Vinayas this actually firmly means, first in the nun's order and then in the monk's order. Now, imagine that this role, you start to study this role as a nun or as a monk, and some of the nuns were very knowledgeable. They could read and write, as we have seen, as we can read in the biographies for nuns. So when this role is getting more known and is being translated in the full Vinaya, people of course start to discuss. They say basically the first ordination of Jing Jian, the first nun ordained in China in 357, this was done in the presence of witnesses, but the witnesses were only monk witnesses, because in the 4th century, no group of nuns ever made it to China, so that there could be a group of witnesses to assist Chinese nuns to build a new institution, a new nunnery. And actually the rule says that the ordination needs to be done in both orders, first in the nun's order, but there was no nun's order, so how can you have 10 non-witnesses if there is no nun's order? In the 4th century, they just did without, and they invited monks as witnesses. But now, in the 5th century, when all these texts are known, people start to discuss about the validity. And we can see this very, very well in the biographies of nuns. We see also, and I will not go too much into details, that they also took into account a lot of other procedures. For instance, there needed to be an ordination platform, there needed to be a kind of ordination district, it had to be in accordance with the Japanese Sutta Karma, so all the procedures needed to be correct. But basically, this was not the main problem. The main problem one had was, when we need non-witnesses. Now, while in the 4th century, the ordination had been done solely in the presence of monks, the non-witnesses will arrive. They will arrive in the, as you can see, circa 433. This is not by chance, although it's still a very amazing event. There was one boat captain, his name is Nanda, who was very much connected with Buddhism. He is, by the way, also said to have translated 2 texts by himself. Of course, we cannot verify that, and the texts are also not extant. But he must have been a very Buddhist person. He was aware of the problematic, which is also something that shows you that the problematic was something that people were discussing about. And he goes to Sri Lanka with his ship and his merchant. So he goes to Sri Lanka and he brings from Sri Lanka a group of nuns that will come to China and that can so assist for the first time the Chinese nuns to build a new institution. We can follow this story in the Bhikshu Nitwan, so again in these biographies of nuns. And we can follow the same story in the Sapo Tuo Shizi Chuan. This is the lineage of Sarvastivada monks. Now, this text is not fully extant. This text actually has totally disappeared, but there are quite some references to this text. It's a text made in the beginning of the 6th century, and there are quite some references to this text, so quotations to this text, without the text being extant. Now, Professor Toru Funayama has made a wonderful work. He collected all these references, put them together, so that we can at least read parts of the text as one collective volume. And luckily for us, the story for nuns is available in this text, so we can follow what happened, what happened according to this text, with the first ordination in the presence of Sinhalese nuns. It's also briefly mentioned in the Kalsung Chuan made in the beginning of the 6th century. What we will never know is that the Vinaya that has been used in the 5th century. Because the 5th century is an eclectic century. So many vinayas were used at the same time. And as we have seen already, people were already happy to have a vinaya. And they did not care so much about which vinaya was used. They were happy to have the fully written down procedures in Chinese. And of course, just as all the other institutions, in the beginning of the 8th century, it will become Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. But in the 5th century, we will never be sure which Vinaya has been used. So, a second ordination, as it's often called, was possible, now in the presence of the witnesses, and these witnesses were indeed fully ordained witnesses, to answer one of the questions I see. So the witnesses need to be fully ordained members of the Sangha, fully ordained bhikshunis. The terms used in China in the commentaries are very often second ordination. The ordination has been done for 300 nuns, well, that's at least what the texts are saying. 300 nuns, that's a lot. And these nuns all came to southern China, Nanjing, and they would then spread the ordination all over China after that. The permission has been given by Gunavarman. Gunavarman is often connected to the Dharmaguptaka tradition, but it's not because he's connected to the Dharmaguptaka tradition that the text that was being used had to be Dharmaguptaka. Because before the ceremony could be held, Gunavarman passed away, and the ceremony was then actually led by Sangavarman, and he is often linked to the Sarvastivada. Now, if I have to guess which Vinaya is used, personally, I would say the Sarvastivada Vinaya, but it's not mentioned. I would say Sarvastivada Vinaya just for the reason that Nanjing at that time was firmly a Sarvastivada region. But in the 5th century, it was not so important. What was more important is the fact that the ordination was done according to the right procedure, and this means with enough witnesses, and also there has to be an ordination platform and so on. Now, this ordination didn't came into being just like that. As we can see in the text I've just mentioned, and particularly in the biographies of nuns, there was actually a lot of discussion. The nuns were doubting, according to the biographies, whether or not their ordination was valid. And they asked these questions to very famous, knowledgeable monks in Vinaya. And Gunavarman is the spokesman, one could say, is the person they address their questions to most often. And he says that the single ordination was not invalid in se. Single ordination means an ordination in the presence of monks' witnesses only. So he says basically the ordination of the first nun, Jing Zhen, was not invalid, and nuns can just follow also in Mahaprajapati's footsteps, so he sees no problem. But one nun particularly, well, she's of course a spokeslady, I would say. I mean, she's not the only one, but she happens to have a biography in biographies of nuns. Now, Hui Guo, she keeps on fearing that stricto sensu, the monk who led the first ceremony, committed an offense, because this monk should have known that this ceremony was not according to the procedure, something was failing. And interesting, actually, is that Gunavarman does not answer this question directly. His answer is, well, actually, the ordination is only invalid if there has not been a training of 2 years. So if the Shikshamana training was not being done. So he does not directly answer Hui Guo's question, but he answers only in case there was no training of 2 years, then the ordination is invalid. But the nuns continue, actually they insist, and Gunavarman in the end gives in and says, well, a second ordination can augment the value of the first ordination. It's not necessary, but indeed it can enhance the value of the first ordination. And then, of course, we have these witnesses arriving. Now, interestingly, these witnesses, and all the sources agree on them, the first group of witnesses who arrived, they were not 10, so not 10 fully ordained nuns came from Sri Lanka in one group. The first group are some nuns, that's what the Bichonichuan is saying. The biography of Gunavarman in the Kalsun Tuan says that there were 8 nuns, and this is also what you will find in the lineage of Sarvastivada monks, 8 nuns. Now, as you will know, this is not enough. You need actually 10 witnesses to have a fully a group of fully ordained nuns and to be valid as an ordination. Of course, in border areas, 5 might be enough. I've never seen a discussion that in this context at least, that China would not consider itself as a border region. Well, there was just some discussion actually, but China did not want to be a border region anyhow, certainly not in the 5th century, so that was already a problem. They really wanted 10 witnesses, and 8 was not enough. So a second group needed to come. According to the Bichuan Yizhuan, the second group consisted of 11 nuns, but in the Disciple Tour of Shuzhi Zuan, the second group is said to have 3 nuns, which according to me is a little bit more plausible, but okay. In any case, the two groups together, they have enough nuns. The total number of nuns, well, 11 or more, so now they really can constitute a group of witnesses that can help the Chinese nuns to have their second ordination. Important also is that the Bichuan Yizhuan says that nuns needed to be fluent in Chinese. I think this is very important because if the nuns needed to be fluent in Chinese, so the Sinhalese nuns needed to be fluent in Chinese, this means that the ceremony, according to me, has been done in Chinese and that the procedures used at least needed to be in Chinese, which makes it very improbable for me that it would have been the Pali Vinaya tradition used for this ordination, but rather I would say one of the Vinayas translated into Chinese already, and then again I would say that the Sarvastivada Vinaya is probably the most probable candidate, but again it was not that important to have a lineage on it. It was more important to have an ordination text. For the Sapo Tuo Shi Zuan, the reason why the nuns needed to be fluent in Chinese was that otherwise there would be no mutual understanding. Now, I had interpreted before that mutual understanding would mean that everyone was reciting the same pratimoksha and so that everyone could follow the procedure. But Professor Funayama says that the mutual understanding could maybe refer to questions asked before the ordination. That's also an interesting suggestion, but yeah, well, we will never fully know. But what is important is that it was all was done in Chinese. People will continue after this event to discuss, and famous commentator Justus Tao Xuan will continue to discuss this event. One thing, maybe between brackets, we don't know is what happened to the Sinhalese nuns after the ordination. I always regret that a bit. I personally would like to know what happened to the Sinhalese nuns once they have done the ordination. Did they remain in China? Did they go to any nunneries? Did they return to Sri Lanka? There is no reference to that, which might show that for the Chinese, what was very important is, well, to have the ordination done properly. And once it was done, yeah, that was the main point, and all the rest somehow disappears from the written text. So, well, that's a pity, actually. But afterwards, people will continue to discuss this event, and Tao Xuan, as you already know, is a very important and influential monk, and he will also discuss this event. And he says the first ordination of Jing Jian, the ordination in the 4th century, was actually valid, but an offense was indeed committed. Supposedly, I would add, by the monk who led the ceremony. This is not what Tao Xuan adds, but this is probably what we can conclude from this context. And he agrees with Gunavarman that the second ordination enhanced the value of the nun's ordination. Important to know also is that even after the event, some people started to discuss whether everything had been done properly and so on. And there is one strong nun, I would say, in the biographies of nuns who says, now it has to stop. If anyone still discusses the validity of this second ordination, she will be put outside of the community. And there is one little sentence that follows that. After that, no discussions. And actually, that's also what we see. We see in Tao Xuan's account that there was no discussion on the validity. The validity of the second ordination was just accepted and no one discussed it anymore. Taoshuan will repeat that the Singhalese nuns needed to be 10 and they needed to learn Chinese, and that they arrived in two groups, a group of 8 and 3, with 10 non-witnesses, and Tie Xianguo as the teacher, the Singhalese teacher. Just to give you one more point of discussion, this is actually what Ta Chui, who is a follower of Taoshuan, so in the same tradition, one could say, well, he starts to doubt a bit, not about the validity, but he says, how is it possible that in China there were only nuns, witnesses, in the 5th century? That's not possible, because we already had institutions in the 3rd century. So there must have been foreign nuns, he says, who came to China before the 5th century. At the end of the Han, beginning of the Wei, the 3rd century, two East Indian nuns must have invited other nuns to China, and they already initiated a legal ordination in the 3rd century, but this tradition got lost. There is no historical reference whatsoever to point out that this might be right, and it's relatively improbable, because there is no reference, first of all, and the travel, the journey was very, very difficult. So maybe if one nun or a few nuns ever made it to China, it's very, very improbable that over the land roads through Sri Lanka, through Central Asia and so on, women would have made the full journey to China. But what is important here is that the Chinese monks actually wanted always to have the events earlier. The 5th century was a little bit too late for them. So he invents, probably, the story of the 3rd century and then says, well, but the tradition got lost. He still agrees that Chinese women could very well follow in Mahaprajapati's footsteps. And then he continues the story just as Taoshuan has done. The first group of Singhalese nuns came, they had to master Chinese and so forth. What is also important, he starts to think, he says, the first group of Singhalese nuns, they must have consisted of 10 nuns. It's not possible, he says, that the first group of nuns, Singhalese nuns, who were on the ship, that there were only 8. Because who could think in Sri Lanka to put 8 women, or to ask 8 women to take a boat to China, which is very, very dangerous actually, especially for women among all these merchants who certainly didn't have a lot of women with them on a common ship. So how can you ask 8 women to take on their journey when you know that 10 is important? So for me, it might maybe mean also that in Sri Lanka, the number 10 was not so important, but the fact that witnesses were needed was important. But that's just a guess. But for Ta Chue, it must have meant that along the way, at least 2 nuns must have died. So that's his solution for this dilemma. Then he says the nuns had to master Chinese, 3 more nuns had to arrive. And actually, after a long, long discussion, he says, well, the so-called second ordination of the 5th century, we cannot call it second. It actually should be called first ordination. First ordination in China. So that's his final point. But just to show you how people continue to discuss, and what is important to note also, is that never, never the validity of the second or maybe first ordination, as Ta Chui then puts it, has been put into question. And that's why from that time on we have these big nunneries that you can see also in China, with ups and downs, of course, that's logical, and there's a lot of history one could add, but as I promised you, I would like to limit my talk here from this spread from India to China. But of course it has been a living tradition, and it has become fully Dharmaguptaka, just as the other institutions, and that's why we still have this living tradition in the Chinese areas. Here, of course, a nice picture I took from Google. I just like the picture. It's a picture of Fo Guan Shan, a very big nunnery, as you all know, in Taiwan. Now, and I take a little bit of water, to come to my last point of introduction today, is actually the Dharmaguptaka regulations for the ordinations. I will briefly summarize them. You have heard them already in the first lecture. You have learned already quite a lot, I think, about ordinations. So I will summarize a bit what the Dharmaguptaka says on Dharmaguptaka Vinaya says on ordinations, but also I would like to point out a few particularities, because of course most of the Vinayas, they are very similar, but they also contain a few particularities, and that might play a role, especially when you discuss the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. Let me first maybe introduce a few terms, but I think you know these terms already. So the first step is, of course, Shramaniri, novice. The second step, Shikshamana, probationer. And the third step, Bhikshuni, nun. So you people can become a novice at the age of, well, at the age when they can chase away crows. This is for male novices. It's not repeated for female novices, but okay, we can think that the rules are probably the same. Anyhow, for a male novice, if you're strong enough to chase away these little bit difficult birds, crows, you can enter the monastic community. And the minimum quorum for a monastic community to function, not to ordain, but to function, is 4 ordained nuns or 4 ordained monks. So as soon as you have a quorum of 4 nuns working together, you can have a nunnery. You need to be actually 10 to fully ordain. In border areas, 5, but many people would say 10 because they don't want to be in border areas. So, but you can function as an institution as soon as you have 4 ordained, fully ordained monks or nuns. An important term that probably also will be discussed in the next lecture is Samagra Sangha. That means something like harmonious Sangha. A Sangha is harmonious when the same Pratimoksha is used, so the same list of rules is used. When for every procedure there is the presence of all monks or nuns in the legal district, that's a kind of definition of the monastery, a geographical, one could say, definition of the monastery. And when the right quorum is obtained for the ceremony. What I think is important too is if we apply this to the ordination and maybe the second ordination of nuns in the presence of the non-witnesses, of the Singhalese non-witnesses, one could actually say that the Singhalese non-witnesses, they were not from the same Pratimoksha lineage, probably, because their ordination probably was Pali Vinaya ordination. And the ordination lineage of the 5th century was a Chinese, whether Sarvastivada or another ordination. But actually the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya says, it might be interesting to compare, maybe someone wants to write an article on that, but the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya says that the same Pratimoksha needs to be recited at for having a valid ceremony. It does say that all the participants need to belong to the same Vinaya tradition, so that all the participants, all the witnesses need to belong to the same ordination, so they need to have had the same ordination. But the Samagra Sangha is interpreted, at least in the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, as the same Pratimoksha needs to be recited at the ceremony. And I think this could inspire quite some discussions. But okay, well, one of the next articles of one of you maybe. And of course, a teacher needs to be present at the... well, thank you, Analia. I was sure you were going to react on that, so that's a very good idea. A teacher, upadhyayini, needs to prepare the candidate for ordination. Now, a novice has to follow 10, well, it's on my next slide, 10 rules. 10 rules. These rules are not to kill, not to steal, no unchaste behavior, and of course they're very similar to the other vinyas. No lying, no alcohol, no perfume, no flowers, singing, dancing, music, no luxury bed, not to eat afternoon, not to touch, and I know there's a lot of discussion on what is touching, but okay, not to touch gold, silver and money. These are the 10 rules of a novice. After having been a novice, one can become a probationer. At least this is the final situation in the fully worked out Vinaya, because a Vinaya is not made from one day on the other. A Vinaya is a growing thing. And at the end phase, we can see there was first a novice step, and then the probationer step, and then the step for a nun. This might not always have been the case, but this is again a topic that you can go into. So a probationer according to the full to the full Vinaya is a step that follows after having been in office, and you and people are probation for 2 years. This is only for women, as you probably all know. So only women have this extra step of 2 years, an extra step as being a probationer. One can become a probationer at the age of 18 unless one is married. Another discussion that has actually been discussed already a lot, and there are many articles on it. We can say that in all probability the biological age is referred to, at least in the Chinese commentators. The Chinese commentaries firmly say that when you're married, you can become a probationer at the age of 10. It's a complex ceremony to become a probationer, which shows that compared to novice, the complexity of the ceremony is enhanced. So that shows actually, according to myself at least, that the probationer had the higher up status in the institution, because the ceremony used to become a probationer is very much complex. It's much more complex than the ceremony used to enter the monastery as a novice. A probationer typically follows 6 rules according to the Dharmaguptaka regulations. This can be different in other vinayas. And these rules in Dharmaguptaka are formulated in very much the same way as the rules for nuns, which shows that they are already quite closer to becoming a nun. These rules are: no sexual intercourse, no stealing, no killing, no lying about one's spiritual achievements, no eating afternoon, no alcohol. And as you will notice immediately, there's quite some overlap between the novice and the probationer. And this has led to many discussions, because it would mean actually that the novice has to follow 10 rules, and that a probationer then only needs to follow 6 rules. So it would seem that a probationer needs to follow less rules than a novice. There's of course a lot of discussion around this, but the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya has found a very interesting solution to that. Actually, and this is very typical for the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, although also in the Mahiṣāsaka Vinaya you will find partially the same method, but the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya has done this very, very consistently. In the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, all the rules for nuns, when possible, include a sentence saying that also novices and probationers need to follow the same rules. The offense committed is different though, but all the rules for nuns are also valid for the for novices and for probationers. This means that a novice, a probationer, and a nun follow exactly the same rules, but the offense committed is different. And the 10 rules for novice and the 6 rules for probationer are actually included in the rules for nuns. So that means that one could say, well, for the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, a novice needs to focus on 10 rules, then 6 more rules or 6 rules need to be particularly looked into by a probationer, but in fact, all the time, you need to follow the same rules. I've put between brackets, when possible, well, there are a few rules for nuns that cannot be applied, of course, to novices and probationers. For instance, rules on nuns being a teacher. A nun as a teacher for a novice and a probationer. Obviously, a novice and a probationer cannot yet be teachers, so these rules are not valid for them. But all the other rules are valid for everyone. And this is probably the Dharmaguptaka solution for this, for these 3 steps. The status of a probationer was probably never fully introduced in China. Well, at least that's what I thought many years. But I must add that in the Tuanhuang manuscripts, one does find a few references to probationers. So some people are classified as probationers. But in the textual tradition, and certainly the later textual tradition, I'm referring then to the 9th, 10th century and so on, there is no proof of an actual presence of probationers in the nunneries. So very probably at a certain time, but it's difficult to say when exactly, the fully introduced or the fully implemented probationer status disappeared from the Chinese nunneries. And they were no longer there. That means that one was first a novice, and then after that a monk, and no one really made a problem out of that. the problematizing, and this is a topic that some people might discuss in the next lectures again, the problematizing of this situation is actually very, very new. Only the last 10 years, one see that people start to think about that. We don't have probationers, we should install them again so to be in accordance with the Vinaya regulations. But it's actually again a quite modern interpretation or a revival maybe of an institution that might never have been fully introduced in China. Another thing to study. As you see, there are still many points that people, just like you, could study. After the ceremonies of a novice and a probationer, there is the full ordination in a dual sangha. That's what the twofold sangha. That's what you find commonly in all vinayas and also in Dharmaguptaka vinaya, with twice 10 witnesses, and that's then what is called the dual ordination. And again, of course, the Dharmaguptaka regulations would say that you need for all regulations, so certainly also for the ordination, the Samagrasanga situation, the harmonious community situation, which means the same Pratimoksha recited, the presence of all monks and nuns in the legal district, and the correct quorum. And before we come to the conclusion, I would like to show you a few pictures so that you can relax a bit. This is actually from the 8th century. This is a picture from the Yulin Cave. This is in the region of Tuanhuang. And what we probably see is the imperial family, and two people from the imperial family enter the monastic community. You can see a woman and a man, and you see that the monastic robe, the kashaya, is ready for them to be put on. In the next slide you see a detail. This is a detail of the woman. Very interesting, by the way, because I just finished a book on bodily care in monastic institutions, is that you cannot use scissors to cut the hair, to shave the hair. You should use a knife. Scissors were seen as something frivol. I never understood, well, still don't understand exactly why, but you can see indeed that always a knife has been used and no scissors. So this is a woman, has her hair shaved, and in the back you can see that the monastic robe is ready for her. And you can see that the man is being shaved, and again the monastic robe is being put ready for him. And this brings me to the conclusion, and well, thank you for your effort to listen to me for such a long time. I hope you find it interesting. And the conclusion basically is that the basis for ordination in Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, but also in China, was always firmly the Vinaya. In China, one never, there might have been some efforts to say, okay, we have to step away from the Vinaya and we have to be more Mahayana by introducing Bodhisattva rules as the basis for ordination. But it's clear that in China, even if these efforts have been done at a certain point, and this would then be the Tang Dynasty, so 8th, 9th, 10th century, the basis for ordination firmly remained the Vinaya. So the Vinaya was the basis for ordination, even if later on Bodhisattva rules for the second step in the ordination have been added. It actually never made it, or the effort was even not very big to abolish the Vinaya. So the basis for ordination with the ordination platforms was always the Vinaya, and then of course the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya that became prominent in the 8th century when it was even imposed with an imperial decree. So these rules became standards, and of course then you have discussions how one has to do it, how to implement these. For the nuns, this meant that in 433 there was a so-called second, some people call it first, ordination for nuns with witnesses from Sri Lanka, and as you know it became even an historical precedent, and certainly this will be discussed in the next lectures. What does it mean, this situation that has been created in China and the dual ordination that has never been discussed and that is active actually until today, gives a lot of opportunities to other women all over the world. So it has never been discussed. It has ever been seen as a legally valid second start, and sometimes it's even called first. So, This brings me to my very last slide. So thank you very much, all of you. I hope you have enjoyed it. And, well, goodbye. Well, thank you. Thank you for all your thanks. And I will switch off my camera right away, and I will switch off my mic.